Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
The evidence and the counter-evidence. I'm struggling with that.
When the facts are filled with coincidences, don't dismiss those coincidences.
I have no tolerance for the unexplainable.
Well then, sir, you'll have no tolerance for me.
Hello and welcome back to Still Watching The Outsider. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
Every week on this podcast, Still Watching, what Richard and I like to do is break down the latest episode of a TV show that we are watching, obsessing over, you name it, we're doing it. We will not spoil anything this week beyond season one, episode 9, titled Tigers and Bears, written by Dennis Lehane and directed by Charlotte Brandstrom. So we are not ruining anything about the finale because we don't know anything about the finale. And in fact, what I'm discovering is a lot of book readers, people who read the Stephen King novel that the show is based on, don't know what's going to happen in the finale. So that's always a fun position to be in. So if you are a book reader or not a book reader and you want to email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, your thoughts, theories, feelings about, the final episodes of The Outsider, we'd love to hear from you. This first email comes from Maureen, who's written it a couple times with some helpful sort of book show comparisons. This is usually my job, so I really appreciate Maureen doing this job for me because I didn't read the book. So Maureen says, really enjoying your podcast. I wish I could have joined in on the survival prediction, but with my book knowledge, it would only lead to spoilers, and I could not find a way to participate spoiler-free. But it says a lot that Richard Price and team has made it so book readers are unsure who will survive as well. I'm guessing with many of your viewers, everyone is very worried about Andy. I'm very glad they added his character because his character adds a lot of suspense because, as we've mentioned before, this is me ad-libbing right now, not Maureen, but because as we mentioned before, Andy's not in the books. So the question of Andy's survival in the finale is anyone's guess. We don't know. Richard and I, I'm sure we'll be talking about what we think is going to happen to Andy. Maureen says she loved the flashback to the 1940s cave-in. It took her a while to realize the flashback was a flashback until she saw the 25-cent sign. Did you think El Coco might nab the kids in the cave or that they would run into it? And then another difference to keep in mind is when the sniper shots start, they have no idea who is shooting at them. We all know about Jack as readers, and Stephen King narration tells us what Jack is, thinking, feeling, experiencing. But as far as anyone in Ralph's group is concerned, Jack is an angry alcoholic detective holding the fort back home. Holly never even meets Jack in the books. I guess now we know why they replaced Claude Sweetbriar's protective mother with an angry, impulsive brother. It's a nice touch and necessary. When reading the Stephen King book, you never doubt the shape-shifting monster exists, so there was no need to have a real character validate by interacting with it. Many changes Richard Price made in story about making sure El Cuco is interacting with our physical world, because we cannot be inside anyone's head in a TV show. So those are some of like Maureen's feedbacks about differences, which, as far as I know, the cave flashback is also in the book. And I actually thought it was really effective. Did the flashback fool you at all, Richard? When it happened?
No, 'cause the clothes on the kids.
Yeah. The flashlights.
Yeah, I mean, even like right in the beginning.
Flashlights. Yeah, yeah. There was a minute where I thought it might be Claude and his brother when they were boys.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, so it was the 1940s, and you know those guys would have been boys maybe in the 60s, but I think because or 70s, I don't want to. I think because of it just gave me such hardcore Stand By Me vibes of these boys like going off into the woods, and so that I think put me in the mindset of like the 50s and 60s, but we were even earlier in the 1940s. Did you like the flashback? Did it work for you, Richard?
I kind of didn't get like what it had to do with anything, because if it wasn't about, I thought it was going to maybe be like an origin story for the outsider or something. And then it kind of wasn't, but I guess the kind of big thing was like that it goes to places where dead people are. And so like there are a lot of dead people in that cave, we find out, you know, or like at least whatever the remnants of the dead people. So I guess it kind of made sense for that. And I don't know. I think that like, that combined with the kind of rumination in the cemetery about the Spanish flu, which, by the way, was not fun hearing about in this corona time. It was just kind of like a sort of deeper textural reminder that like tragedy has stalked the world forever. And,
right.
You know, that's just the world we live in. And, you know, I just think it just added a bit of that sort of sorrow and sort of dread, I guess, to a show that's already pretty well lacquered in those emotions.
Yeah, I have to say that if I like this episode, but if of all the episodes that we've had this season, this one made me feel the most like this could have been an 8-episode season.
Yeah, same.
It felt mm-hmm. like yeah, it felt like
wheel spinning. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. two quick things to mention before we before I give my cave flashback thoughts, which I know you're dying to hear. One correction is that last week I said that the actor Paddy Considine is Irish. He's not. He is British. A lot of people wrote in to talk to me about that. I just wonder, by what right does he call himself Paddy if he's not Irish, is my question.
I thought he was Irish too, because I had seen him
in America. That,
well, no, but also that Jez Butterworth play that was on Broadway that was like, there was like 40 people in the cast and a live goose and I can't remember the name of it now.
I can't remember it either.
Anyway, he was the lead and he played an Irishman, so I just assumed.
He has played many an Irishman. His name mm-hmm. is Paddy, but he is in fact British, so let the record reflect. Also, I think I said at one point that none of the like people that El Cuco had copied had survived, but that's incorrect, of course. We met the woman in prison over in New York. She's still hanging in there as far as we know. So, you know, there's hope for Claude, that Claude might make it through. And then a lot of people seemed concerned about whether or not El Cuco had scratched, I'm going to call him Grumpy Cave Dad, is what I've decided to call him, in the fight that they had last week. I didn't really get into it because I kind of thought it was irrelevant, since the transformation cycle is 20 plus days. It's not like the monster was going to like immediately double another person. That's not how his like system works.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt irrelevant to me whether or not he scratched the dad, because I am assuming this ends with the monster dead. If it doesn't end with the monster dead, if it ends with the monster limping off into the distance and slowly turning into this bearded man, then like, you know, I will admit that I was wrong, but I cannot see a version of this show where this monster survives, but who knows?
Yeah. I think part of the reason the conversation happened with the grandfather and the grandson, you know, with Ralph was, you know, when he asked about the scratches, it's kind of related to the Spanish flu thing, where it's just like this idea of, maybe this is just in my head because of real world events, but like this idea of disease and like things spreading, you know, like that. And so even if like it doesn't narratively really matter whether or not he the outsider scratched anybody and where they are in this where it is, and it's sort of like reproductive cycle or whatever you want to call it, regeneration cycle. It just puts in mind that sort of fear that this is like an unstoppable thing spreading, you know?
Yeah, no, sorry. And thank you for saying, granddad. I should have said cave granddad. that idea of infection, I think comes through the most in the speech that Claude gives, right? About like he gets out of the car, he throws up, he's with Howie, they're going to go get chicken or whatever. And he sits in the passenger seat and he talks about like a cold, cancer, it doesn't matter what it'll get in. It doesn't matter what it is. If it wants to get in, it'll get in. And this thing got in, and this idea of this thing, as a cancer, as a disease, and just like the influenza or something like that. That's a show difference from the book. I know because someone wrote in earlier that the character of Jack has cancer, and that the outsider like promises to cure him if he helps him. That's sort of like how the outsider is controlling him. So I think they abandoned that. As far as I know, we've had no indication that Jack has cancer, but that idea of a disease, of an infection, and the way it spreads, the way the grief spreads, all that stuff. I think the show has done a really good job of imagining this creature like that.
Yeah. And then in last week, when the outsider ate the hunter that Jack killed, he was like, he was full of cancer, you know?
Oh, right.
Like, the only pure things are children, and just our bodies just like, and the environment just like kind of like fail us as we get older.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
And to that end, I mean, I think that, you know, I'm going to go back to the setting of the caves, and I don't know that I can fully defend the cave flashback, because I think it was just like a little bit more elaborate than it needed to be to get the point across. But the horror of the underground setting of the caves. Maybe it's just my own claustrophobia, but like the horror of the underground setting, of the dad being down there and being able to hear the boys but not being able to get to them. And then the idea that they all like died in this cave-in slowly. The fact that that is, you know, based on whatever previews for next week, seems to be the setting of a showdown. Like, I think establishing the real world natural horror of this physical location, even outside of the monster that is now lurking in the belly of it, that ups my anxiety about the finale, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It kind of reminded me of, in some ways, the kind of incredible opening scene of The Leftovers season 2, where it's like set 10,000 years in the past or something like that. And it's right. Just this like woman who's pregnant and gives birth and she dies, and you know, and it's just this like grueling thing about like, that kind of reminds you of like, is like, that unfortunately, ever since there's been anything alive on Earth, there has been pain, there has been death, there has been catastrophe, you know, and Ralph and Holly and everyone are attending to this particular immediate thing. But here's the show, this story reminding us that, well, you know, 70 years ago, this other horrible thing happened on the very ground you're about to be standing on. And like that, you know, unfortunately, we can't stop that bigger force, but like at least we can maybe locate one thing, one disease, isolate that and tackle that, and then kind of carry on with the business of living.
One thing that I think we talked about, we felt like these few episodes that we have here, out of town needed to do was really, establish Claude as a character that we cared about, were very invested in. And that's how I felt anyway. If that is something that they should have accomplished in these episodes, how effectively do you feel they've done that, Richard?
I don't know exactly. I also think that adding this brother character in kind of at the very end and giving him kind of stuff to say and do. And Holly said to him at one point in this episode, we need you. And it was I feel like it's kind of distracted from Claude a little bit. And I think maybe earlier in the season, we just needed to spend more time with him. And I think that maybe the fear was, that the viewers would figure out too soon why we were focusing on him. But, I'm having a little trouble sort of really caring about his whole deal. And I think it's also, unfortunately, partly owed to Considine's kind of wobbly accent. And it's hard for me to kind of commit to the character, when there's that distraction. I don't want to see the character die or anything. It's not I think it maybe would have been more effective if we just knew him a bit better by now.
There is the pair of scenes, which is the side of the road with Howie and then at the chicken, the chicken place with Howie, where he's talking about you don't remember me right sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I feel like those were attempts to create this character as someone that we cared a lot about. And I don't think it really landed. And I don't know if that's up to the acting or the writing or what, but I'm just sort of do I want him to die? No, but you're right. I think the character of Seal Bolton, his brother, is sucking up a lot of the oxygen in the room. And some of his energy is really compelling to watch, the way in which he sort of, sparks against Holly and what she has to put up with there. That's interesting to me. His whole line about how she should be washing the cups or whatever. That's
right.
That's, compelling television. But is it adding to what I'm going to need for the end? I don't know. We'll find out.
I think this is a common problem with shows like this that are so atmospheric and about a kind of mood of dread or something looming, in their early episodes, they really just take their time just setting the scene and kind of making us wonder what's really happening, what this is all about. And then they eventually, though, do actually have to get to the plot and move toward an ending, And I think that a lot of times, and I'm feeling this a little bit with this episode, all of a sudden it's feels very rushed. And you're wait, but mm-hmm. where's that pacing, that kind of enveloping thing? And it's impossible to fully sustain that for a whole run of a season of television. But I think if they had reshaped the season a little bit, so maybe a little bit more had happened an episode or two ago, and so there was more of a kind of gentle arc rather than what we're experiencing now. I don't know. This episode kind of felt both filler and not enough,
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. And they've been tremendously effective. There are plenty of people that I am very, very invested in, very worried about, mm-hmm. I'm worried about Ralph and Holly. I'm worried about Andy. I'm embarrassed to admit it, but I did. I gasped when Alec Pelley got a bullet to the head. And
even though you called it.
That's a character that hasn't had a lot of screen time, but I think has been tremendously effective. Even in this episode, when he has this whole thing about it's little bites, mm-hmm. what I mean? When he's talking mm-hmm. to Ralph about how to believe in something that you can't believe in. And even with the heavy foreshadowing of tasting pennies or something like that, which apparently is a Richard Price thing. I guess Richard Price has used that speech about tasting pennies in your mouth and multiple, things that he's done. But I was sad to see him go, and felt like a true loss. It didn't feel like a random red shirt there with them. It felt like a true loss and something that made us really scared for the four other people who are standing there as it cuts to black and you just hear the shots more and more and more and more shots firing. I thought that ending was really effective. So
yeah, it's kind of, first of all, with Alec, I just think back to, I think it was either episode five or six where he's kind of downstairs talking to
Howie.
Yeah. And he's like, you know, like maybe there are demons or whatever. Like, so he was one of the first people who was like willing to listen to Holly and willing to kind of accept this crazy idea. And so that to see him kind of be one of the first victims of it, like, it's just kind of sad. And I also love that actor, Jeremy Bob. He's really good.
He's great. And, yeah.
The thing with the gunshots was like, I don't know about your life, but I can assume I'm just, you're not around guns very often or ever even. And, you know, obviously we hear them a lot in movies and TV shows, but like the way that it was just, it wasn't like machine gun. It was just like one, you know, like it just brings to mind so many recent events and what they maybe sounded like, and just like the kind of hammering repetition of it. Like, it was really it was really a brutal way. I watched it for the first time last night, like you did, I'm sure, and just like, it was like a kind of a weird way to like end Sunday night. You know, like I think I put on some like Guy Fieri or something just to like decompress,
palate cleanse. Yeah, it was so disturbing, and just the force of the sound. And as you say, it wasn't like just rapid fire. It was because, okay, so we had this background on Jack, and I had predicted that maybe Jack's sniper did not go the way that I had hoped for Jack. I was hoping he would use his sniper skills, to help our good guys. I was incorrect, at least so far. And so we know that he has a background as a sniper. And so, you know, and that his first shot is just like a headshot. Immediately takes out a character, right? And so, and then we're worried about these other four characters. And then you hear not just like, I think they could have done it where they cut to black and you hear another shot, but you hear so many shots, and there's that pause and that re-aiming between each shot. And it was just, it was brutal. It was brutal. It was really good. I'm looking at a post-it that I wrote last week, and at the top it says Alec RIP. Where are we on Andy Watch? Did that kiss seal it for him? Is he done?
I don't know. I just can't decide how grim this show wants to be in the end, you know? And I think that for Holly to, you know, open herself up to something like this, and then to just take it away from her, like, I'm not sure if that's really the show's kind of, is like kind of thematic intent. But I don't know. I mean, it's like that those gunshots at the end are so scary because they're singular and they suggest real intent. You know, it's shoot, aim at somebody else, shoot, aim at somebody else, shoot, you know? So it can't just be Alec that, you know, taken down by this, but I don't know. I'm choosing to think positively about Andy, but I guess it's just a matter of how grim this show wants to be.
Yeah, I feel like I don't want to reduce the show to like who's gonna live and who's gonna die. That's definitely not the most interesting thing to talk about the show, but it is, for me at least, an interesting thought experiment when I don't know what's gonna happen in a final episode of a show, to do exactly what Richard is doing, which is like try to be like, okay, what is this show trying to be? Try to figure out like, what story the writers are trying to tell here. And I got to say, like last week, I agreed with you when you said you thought Ralph was safe because you didn't think the show would want to leave Jeannie alone. But then this week, when we have both like Jeannie saying over and over again on the phone that she doesn't want Ralph to go confront this monster, and then you have the Jeannie Glory, like, sort of bonding scene. And so then I'm like, I could see an ending where, like, it's Jeannie and Glory together trying to, like, shelter in their grief together sort of thing. If Ralph doesn't make it. But I will tell you this, if Ralph doesn't make it, then I think Andy does make it. Like, he might get injured or something like that. But, like, to give Holly that thing to hold on to at the end is something that I think the show would do. So my current predictions, once again, I know this is not the most sophisticated way to talk about a TV show, but my current predictions are Ralph dies and Andy gets wounded but lives. That's what I think is going to happen. So no matter what, Holly lives, though. Holly absolutely lives. No one's touching Cynthia Erivo. Not a hair on her head. No, thank you. So let's talk about that Jeannie and Glory thing, which I thought was a really interesting scene. And not just an excuse to, like, you know, have the actresses be in the episode. I really liked this thing that Glory says to Jeannie, where she says, I respect the sincerity of your beliefs, which I like almost want like a tattoo of. Like that, I was just like, that is just something that we are so bad at doing as humans. When someone doesn't believe what we believe, to say, I respect the sincerity of your belief. And I'm thinking specifically like spiritually and religiously, but you know, it could be in any different avenue of your life. Did that line hit you hard in any way, or was that just me?
I thought it was interesting that it was the button to that scene. Like it was, that was ultimately the point of that scene was her saying that, you know? And I think it's a nice sentiment, but I also wonder like what it really means. Like what are the limits of that, you know? Because in certain cases, me respecting the sincerity of someone's beliefs means that I have to respect the fact that they think because I'm gay, I'm going to hell, or because you're a woman, you shouldn't be able to do X, Y, Z, you know? And so like, so obviously there are limits to it. And I don't think it was a particularly theological thing that she was saying. I think it was more that on second viewing, I kind of like thought differently about that line. And it was more about like her saying, look, like I've been saying a lot, the world is scary. Things are dark. We can't control things. If you have something that you need to kind of believe to, you know, kind of keep yourself upright, essentially, then I respect that you need that. And I don't think that you're wrong to need that. I just am going to do it a different way, you know, because Glory knows that Jeannie is grieving, and is worried for, you know, potential future grief if something happens to Ralph. And, I don't know. I think it was more just about like, we're in this together and like, however you choose to kind of process it or, you know, kind of work your way through it. Like that's okay. So I don't think it was specifically dogmatic in any way. It was just like a big kind of like sigh of understanding and empathy.
Yeah. And just, benefit of the doubt of intention, you know what I mean, is the gift that Glory gave Jeannie, where she's just like, we might be on really the opposite side of certain things around this case, but one thing I know is that you are looking out for me and I'm here for you as well, sort of thing. The other necessary-ish part of that scene was, you know, Glory has this info that the district attorney tried to talk to her about this, you know, other young victim that was found on a trail. This is something that sort of percolates over the course of the episode, that we've got another young boy. The way that the district attorney reacts to this evidence feels like he's having a, you know, because we saw him get really ambitious around the Terry Maitland conviction. And then when it all went south, he was just sort of like, I think he was going to run for higher office or something like that. And then he decided not to, because he was just like, this is all so ugly. And then the existence of this other young victim seems to further underline Terry's innocence, right? Because it happened after Terry died. I'm curious. I don't know that I fully understand its functions in the show. Is it meant to present like an El Cuco-less real world alternate solution to, you know, the Terry Maitland question? Like what are we meant to take from this second boy? I don't think it's supposed to be a victim of El Cuco, right?
No,
didn't feel correct to me. So like,
no, I kind of have two minds about it. One is just that it's like, here's the further chaos of the world. And like, even if you take out one thing, there's another thing lurking or whatever. But I think you can illustrate that, and the show has illustrated that in ways that don't involve this character from earlier in the season, who we kind of forgot about.
I definitely forgot about him.
So what I think it, yeah, me same. I mean, what I think it's setting up is, you know, it's something that, I think it was, Seal was saying like, okay, so you call the police and then what do you tell them? You know, and Ralph's like, oh, you don't have to. We just say that, you know, blah, blah. So my guess is that it's somehow going to be like whoever did that to that other kid is going to be sort of like they'll just roll that all up together. And so they don't even have to deal with like this monster thing, you know?
Right.
So like
supernatural. Right.
The band of merry men, whoever survives, and Holly will know what happened, but the rest of the world will just kind of be like, oh, look, it was this thing, and never be the wiser about all that. I think it was kind of setting up like the plausible explanation, even though it's not true at all. Yeah.
Right. Correct. I agree with that. I just think it was, I don't know, this whole episode hangs together weirdly for me. So we've got, let me ask you a question. So, you know, Jack gets all of his weaponry together and goes to find a perch because they get, you know, they get warning that, the as you say, the band of merry men are coming to the caves because Seal stupidly told, you know, how he got high, and Seal told Claude, what the plan was. That all felt extremely clumsy to me. Like why they wouldn't put a, you know, someone a little bit better than Howie on the case if Howie is like gonna just, you know, it also felt like Howie wouldn't have done that, like let his guard down that much in that way and all that sort of stuff. So, that all felt very convenient as a way for, you know, the monster to get the info, but our heroes not know that the monster have the info that they're coming. Right.
Right.
But so since the monster does have this info, you know, Jack is sent out to sort of guard the cave, and we get this shot of him setting up, and there's a snake on the rock, sort of like nearby the shot. He's in the background and the snake is sort of like snaking around, the rock where he's setting up. So there's a couple options here. One, this is like Chekhov's snake, right? And like, it's gonna strike Jack, in next week's episode, stopping him maybe somehow. Is that possible? Maybe. But to me, it feels more like the bug shot from another episode, where it's just like the, you know, it goes back to sort of what you're talking about. This like the life cycle of, the natural world, the dangers of the natural world, like ever all the creepy crawlies that are out here in rural United States, you know, that just add all this like great atmosphere to this horror story. You know, a snake also like sloughs off its skin the way that El Coco does and stuff like that. So that's like an especially like good image to have right then. But I don't know, that sort of, did you have any, different snake thoughts?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's the kind of the danger of the natural world. I think, you know, something that's always so, whenever you read these like crazy stories about someone attacked by a mountain lion or a bear or something like that, you know, it doesn't happen that often in America. But my first instinct is to be like, oh, but like, why would it do that to somebody? And it's like, the bear doesn't know. The bear doesn't know it's a person or the person's narrative or anything like that. The snake, the natural world is indifferent to us, you know? And I think that we've gotten a couple of reminders of that with a snake, you know, and the cave collapse and all that. And obviously the snake, you know, biblical stuff, symbol of evil, symbol of the devil, whatever,
right.
Or Voldemort or whatever, you know, whatever. You know, but yeah, I think it's more just kind of reminding us yet again, like that these people are surrounded by danger, that everyone is surrounded by potential danger at all times. And like between, you know, children getting abducted and children getting trapped in caves and all manner of other things, it's a wonder that anyone lives past 8 years old. You know, like there's so much scary stuff out there. And the trick about being alive is to manage that fear and manage that worry, in a way that like you're not just kind of bogged down in like despair and misery at all times.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, I think that, the biblical stuff is important to have peppered throughout the show because the theme of belief is so important. And I wanted to take that opportunity to talk about like Ralph and his belief in the state of it in this episode, because, you know, we have that look at the end of last week where Holly and Ralph are looking at each other and we were kind of like, is Ralph like fully on board now? And what we find on this episode is he's not. So there's still an opportunity, I think, for Ralph to either have a I fully believe moment or falter because he never is able to quite get there. Because what he says in this episode to Howie is like, if I were you, you know, while you're around these folks, just go ahead and pretend you believe. And it seems like that's not that Ralph is like fully pretending, but that he's just like really having trouble with it, you know? And so I think that's gonna be the question when it comes down to it for Ralph is like, can he get all the way there and believe that what he's fighting is a real monster? Or will he not be able to get there? And I think if he can't get there, then he's not going to make it out of the series alive. I think that's sort of the crux of it. And I'm not sure what, if that's the case, I'm not sure what Richard Price or Stephen King would be trying to say with that. But it seems like in terms of the way we approach the world, the way Holly approaches the world is the good and ideal way to do it. And then Ralph is sort of stopped up in a way, like congested in a way that he needs to like get past, is sort of what we're seeing this journey for these characters. Is that your sense as well?
Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I just really don't know. I guess I mean, it's a silly thing to say, but I just don't know what the show will be trying to say until it says it, you know?
Yeah.
And, I think that Ralph's journey has not been one of like the hero who martyrs himself or anything like that or dies for the cause. That doesn't really feel like where I think for me, it's more about, accepting the unknown, you know, as a reality. And even if they're doing that by having something actually be known in a kind of concrete form, in the form of the outsider, like, I think it's, you know, just him saying like, it changes everything about how we see the world or whatever the line is, you know? And, I don't know that him dying at the end would really make a sort of powerful point, because then he wouldn't be seeing anything anymore, you know? But I don't know. But then again, I think, well, okay, they brought in this other kid and who's been murdered, and like maybe he could look to that and be like, well, that's what it is. Like we were just going after the wrong person or whatever. I don't know. Maybe they'll have it. It'll have a very ambiguous ending.
There's also like the fogginess of it all. Like, you know, Claude talks about, you know, the fogginess of being inhabited by this creature. So like, you know, will they be able to solidly remember, everything when they're all done? Or will they be able to, you know, peg it all on, you know, Jack going rogue or a bear attack or whatever they want to call it? All right. I have a couple, really important questions before we call it a day here. One is, would you rather eat Highway Heaven chicken or Big Daddy's Hangry Barbecue?
Oh my God. I mean, this is, you know, and I whatever, however you answer, Joanna, just know that I respect the sincerity of your beliefs.
Mm-hmm. I, however, do not. There is a wrong answer.
If I say the wrong thing, I'm going to hell. You know, I gotta say, I'm sure the roadside fried chicken is great. But like something, the place didn't look like it was like in that great shape. So I'm going to have to go with, you know, a classic in the Hangry Barbecue.
We're divided again. I got to go with Highway Heaven Chicken. How can you say no to something with heaven in the title?
That's true.
Anyway, let us know what you guys think about, this fried chicken. And, you know, if you guys are fried chicken experts, I am not, because I have never lived in the South. But if you are, let us know. And then also I want to talk to you about what they did with Andy in this episode, because, you know, we've been worried about Andy for, you know, 5 straight episodes now or something like that. So, you know, we didn't need to get there with him, but let's talk about a few things. First of all, cemetery date. Where Andy is like, I choose to believe they died of loving each other too much. Then we stand a man who does the dishes, right? When Seal does this thing where he looks at Holly and he's like, you know, basically, to the only female in the room, shouldn't you be doing dishes? And then Andy goes ahead and does them, right? Mm-hmm. And then this like adorable scene where they're in the car and he's like trying to calm her down by getting her to focus on like identifying movie quotes. Mm-hmm. Which she can about movies that she's never seen. And he like obviously just like loves that about her. Man, they just really did a lot of good work with Andy in this episode. That's all I have to say. So I didn't need to love him more, but I do. So,
you know. And it's such a gentle kind of credible thing. You know, he's not like superhumanly kind or whatever. It's just like, it's kind of nice little subtle things. And I don't know. I have to believe that, like, I mean, Richard Price and Dennis Lehane, like, they're humanists. Like, they, you know, there's generally some, not hope necessarily, but there's some sense of, like, grace, in their stories. So I'm just hoping that they, you know, they can kill, honestly, they could kill whoever else they want, just not Holly and Andy.
So RIP Eunice,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I had the Derek Cecil, who's playing Andy, is just like, I think there's something, there's a number of things that they did to really, really, really just, like, you know, hit us over the head with how much we should like and care about Andy. But, like, it's something as simple as Holly is, you know, they talk about, like, what a lid for every pot or whatever, right? And Holly is someone who moves through the world with some difficulty given the way that she interacts with people. And so there's something that does our hearts as audiences good to see someone who appreciates her so much for fully who she is. And just the way he, like, he just has to, like, smile at her with a great deal of respect and affection, when she does what she does, to make us love him. Because we care about Holly and we're rooting for her. And, so yeah. So how dare they make me so scared for Andy? And, I don't know how I'm going to live with all this anxiety until next week, Richard.
I know.
Maybe, well, I should, drown my sorrows in some Highway Heaven chicken or something like that. I don't know.
There you go. That sounds like a healthy response.
Yeah, that's totally, yeah, healthy. All right. So yeah, is there anything left to talk about in this episode, or anything, like, you know, we presume we're going for a classic King hero versus monster, you know, Pennywise in the sewers, standoff. But, you know, and there's going to have to be some sort of emotional catharsis for our characters, in theory, Ralph, to allow him to have victory over this monster, dealing with him, maybe processing his kid's death in a way that he has yet been able to, something like that. Yeah. We've got the second wave cavalry of the Bolton brothers and Howie, like, as an, you know, as someone who could, as people who could, like, oh, I don't know, get a wounded Andy to safety, maybe, something like that. You,
sure,
know, we've got some other folks coming. I have some questions around Jack. I'm still rooting for Jack to, play hero in some way, to really fight against the thing that has a hold of him and help out and play hero. His work at the end of this episode, though, is not, giving me a lot of hope for that, but I have to think that that's something we might see in the finale. Do you have any finale wishes or thoughts?
Well, just because I keep mentioning it, and why not mention it one more time? I just hope there, you know how, like, again, it was so surprising when True Detective first season ended on that note of hope where, you know, the light is winning.
Yeah.
I just hope we kind of get something similar with that, because for all that's happening outside of the world of this show, it would be nice to, after spending, you know, let's say 9 hours and 48 minutes in the dark, just to spend a few in the light, you know, at the very end of the episode. I don't know if that means, like, we close on just a scene of, like, Jeannie and Ralph and Glory having dinner, or Andy and Holly going on a date, or, like, something, you know, just something to remind us that, like, while there is the world is dark and full of terrors, but also, some nice things to cling to make our way through all those terrors.
Excellent. Yes. I will wish for Andy and Holly to go on a date and go watch the 1942 film, The Man Who Came to Dinner, which is an excellent film, by the way, Betty Davis film that was referenced in this, episode. That seems only fitting, as a date that they could go. No more cemetery dates is what I'm saying.
Yeah. It's
all
enough.
Dates we've in had future, a, yeah. Should be movie dates. All right. So until next week, Richard, where can folks find you?
Oh, well, my brother wants to show me this really cool cave, so I'm going to go look at that with him, I think. And if, okay, I get reception, I'll tweet from Rylaws and, be posting to vanityofhair.com. Where will you be?
Oh yeah. I'm going on a date to a cemetery. I'm I'm brushing up on my facts about the, Spanish flu, because I think that will just really seal the deal for me. Yeah. On that date. Nothing more romantic. I will also be tweeting from at Joe Wrote This. You can hear both of us on the podcast Little Gold Men, and we will see you to either mourn Andy or rejoice praise in his survival. Praise him. I'll praise Andy. Next week on the final episode of Still Watching The Outsider.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ audio network like Last Days and TMZ Verified. Available on all podcast platforms.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.